Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, concerns about mental health among rural Iowans as the pandemic intensifies. But first, Hollywood has received a lot of well-deserved criticism for a lack of diversity and representation of African Americans on the big screen through the decades. But through the history of film, there has also been a great deal of misrepresentation of Black lives, often relegated to supporting roles as domestic servants, criminals, sassy best friends, put upon single moms, or even somewhat mystical beings. Strides have been made in recent years. Novotny Lawrence is associate professor in Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication and the Department of English. He's studied how the portrayal of Black lives on screen has been evolving and how the film industry influences social issues. He'll be giving a virtual lecture, White Mansions, Black Bodies, Jordan P. Get Out and the New Age Slave Plantation at 6 p.m. Thursday evening, November 5th. And he is on the line with me now. Novotny, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I think if we just look at a recent trend, which is the disclaimer of stereotypical racist presentations in film, something that we're seeing on the Disney Channel and on Disney Plus, and something that we're seeing on HBO, there is a growing recognition that this has been a problem throughout the history of film.
Well, I think that, you know, the word that you use there, which is really important, is that you say trend. We are kind of seeing some progress, as you mentioned, say on the Disney Channel and even the theaters, when we start thinking about films like Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk and Widows. And so we're seeing these things right now. The problem is that it's never been anything for Hollywood to treat Black people like a trend. We've seen this kind of uptick in representation before, only to have it fade away. For example, I conduct research on an area called Blaxploitation films. Those movies came out in the 1970s. They were around for 5 years, saved some major Hollywood companies from going bankrupt. Shaft saved MGM from going bankrupt, and Superfly saved Warner Brothers. And then after 5 years, those films were gone, and many of the stars never worked again. In the 90s, we had what were called hood films, with Boys in the Hood, New Jack City, movies like that. It was a trend. And so the idea is that we have to sustain representation and not treat Black people like fads. They're here one day and very viable at the box office or on television, and then gone the next. And so I think that whenever I see a moment like this, I'm excited. But at the same time, I'm leery, because we know that Hollywood has not been able to stay true to that kind of representation.
Well, and of course, this goes beyond the representation that we see on film. If you go behind the scenes in Hollywood, there's a representation problem there that is reflected in what we see on film, right?
Absolutely. The number of Black directors who get opportunities are few and far between when we compare those to their white counterparts. And then if we want to talk about Black women as directors, I mean, that's even more tough, even more difficult. You know, we have filmmakers now, you know, like a Jordan Peele, like Steve McQueen, Ava DuVernay, Gina Prince-Bythewood, who are making some inroads. But I got to come back to that theme, which might just be the way it goes today during this interview, of you got to continue to give people opportunities. And when that doesn't happen, then those stories tend to fade away.
Well, and in giving people opportunities, you make a really important point that we can't just promote Black directors, or we can't give Black directors an opportunity to work just based on their past success. I mean, when a white director makes a bad film, they often get to make another film, but that's not necessarily what we see when a Black director makes a bad film, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Opportunity and true opportunity in Hollywood includes being able to fail. Not everything hits. You know, a director right now who's working like a Christopher Nolan is very rare. He's been very fortunate in his career in that, you know, all of his films, generally speaking, have been hits. There are going to be some ups and some downs. And all too often, because Black lives are not essentially valued in Hollywood, and there's a prevailing notion that people don't want to see Black people on screen, and they certainly won't go see films by Black directors, that when someone black, whether they're in front of the camera or behind the camera, when they fail, the execs go, see, we told you. And so then they're kind of, you know, taken out of the loop. They don't get the same opportunities to build that cultural capital or to fail like their white counterparts do. And that's really unfortunate because it's just unfair. And a lot of this are business practices, but they're business practices that are ultimately made on racist stereotypes that again, perpetuate that mythology that black people just aren't as valuable as their white counterparts. And so that's what historically in the cinema and other forms of media, you know, black actors, black directors, black screenwriters, that's what they're up against.
I would love to go through some of these trends that we have seen in the past, because as you said, there have been moments, shining moments with some really great art being made or progress being made in some other way through history. But we often come back to these stereotypical roles. And of course, in early film, primarily, we saw African-Americans playing servants or even field hands, right?
That's it. That's correct. There's a book called Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks. And it's kind of, you know, one of the texts that really lays out these five archetypes that blacks were relegated to playing in early films. And it does very well while racism is overt in this country, because you see those types over and over again. So, for example, the mammy archetype, this, you know, sassy, overweight, domineering, masculinized portrayal of a black woman. And essentially that's what Patricia Hill Collins calls a controlling image. She's a caretaker of sorts. All she wants to do is really serve her white family. And this is a justification for the ways in which black women were treated in slavery. Again, that's what Patricia Hill Collins tells us. And that character sustains. And you see it in films like Gone with the Wind. You know, Hattie McDaniel plays that role. Her name is Mammy in the film. And you know, the actors, like, Hattie McDaniel ultimately wins an Academy Award for it. But it's that kind of caricature that sustains, and it's probably the ways in which black women have been depicted in films, more than any other way. So that was one. You know, for black men, it was largely this coon caricature, this really lazy, stupid, kind of conniving caricature who is the comic relief in films. And you see this in countless films. You know, Step and Fetch It was a performer, and he perfected that role. Oftentimes couldn't speak English correctly. Again, just lazy, stupid, wanted to avoid work. I mean, these are the ways in which Donald Bogle defines that caricature. And so, yeah, more often than not, that was the way that we saw black people on screen. And they're based in stereotypes. I think that's the important thing. They're based in prevailing thoughts and attitudes about what it means to be black anyway. And so there's a social impact, too, because you have people that was their only way of ever experiencing black folks. And so if you're being told that they're unintelligent or being told that all black men are sassy, and you're getting these images in the absence of anything else, there's nothing else, that's what you're given, then people start to believe those things. And so there's a danger in these stereotypes, too.
I can think of a few films that were really, I think, extraordinary in the late 1960s. Did we see any standout roles for black actors and really develop black characters before the civil rights movement?
I think that there are some moments. In particular, we could never discount the importance of the black independent film movement that took place, you know, in the beginning in the 1960s. Teens, and then, you know, it sustained. There was one filmmaker named Oscar Michaud who makes his last film in the 1950s. And again, this is independent of Hollywood. But there's a segment of filmmakers, you know, we had the Lincoln Motion Picture Company, the Michaud Film Company, the Riola Motion Picture Company, where Black says, okay, Hollywood, you will not portray us well. We're going to seize the means of production, and we're going to make films that tell our own stories and position us as a viable people. And you know, unfortunately, many people don't know about that black independent film movement. But out of that, right, comes a significant number of films that, again, just demonstrate black life unpandered and in more accurate ways than, say, Hollywood films. Some titles that come out of that period include Within Our Gates. There's another really important film that comes out of there called Body and Soul. And so we can't forget that movement. So in that regard, yes, those films ultimately played in a lot of churches and schools that were for Black people because they couldn't, those artists couldn't get distribution. But, you know, I would feel badly if I didn't highlight the works of those directors. So there were those critically important moments. In terms of Hollywood, you know, it seems to be that civil rights really has a tremendous impact on what we start seeing on screen. You know, there's no coincidence that a wonderful performer like Sidney Poitier begins his ascension to becoming the biggest movie star in the world, regardless of ethnicity, in the 1950s. And so he was that glimmer of hope for a long time that demonstrated there could be progress and change. Certainly a performer like Dorothy Dandridge in the film Carmen Jones kind of demonstrated too that African-Americans can be viable. They can play these roles in these films made by major directors and people will go see them. Like white people, Black people, other people of color will go see them, but you got to have the opportunity. So I would highlight films like In the Heat of the Night. I mentioned Carmen Jones, another Sidney Poitier vehicle, Lilies of the Field. I would say a film like, in addition to In the Heat of the Night and Lilies of the Field, I would also look at Sidney Poitier's film To Sir With Love. So there were moments, but again, they were few and far between.
Yeah, I was just looking up To Sir With Love and In the Heat of the Night, which are two of my favorite movies of all time. And they were both, they both came out in 1967. So, I mean, that, of course, right after the Civil Rights Movement, and what an incredibly powerful moment and powerful films. But how long did that kind of momentum last?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about, you know, that moment is that, okay, so certainly, you know, the way that I talk about Sidney Poitier, who I just think is fantastic, is he on the screen is kind of emblematic of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., right? In that he is the maybe preeminent kind of nonviolent performer. Instead of hitting back if someone abuses him, he's going to give a speech about it. And you know, he's safe. And I don't mean this as a criticism for Sidney Poitier. He is what we needed at that time. As his career moves through the 1950s and into the 60s, a different generation starts to emerge, those who are more connected to, say, Black power philosophies. And so,
and you know what, we're going to pick up, we are going to pick up right there after a break. I am talking with Novotny Lawrence, associate professor in Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication and the Department of English. He'll be giving a virtual lecture on Thursday called White Mansions, Black Bodies, Jordan Peele's Get Out, and the New Age Slave Plantation.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation iCORE training program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, concerns about mental health among rural Iowans as the pandemic intensifies. Right now, we're talking about Black lives on the big screen. My guest is Novotny Lawrence, associate professor in Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication and the Department of English. And he's giving a lecture, a virtual lecture on Thursday called White Mansions, Black Bodies, Jordan Peele's Get Out, and the New Age Slave Plantation. That's at 6 p.m. Thursday evening, November 5th. And of course, you don't have to be on campus to go to a lecture these days. Novotny, just before the break, we were talking about, okay, those movies that came out, particularly those Sidney Poitier films of the late 1960s, that were a real change, a real shift for Hollywood, but also indicative of what was going on in our culture. And then as we moved into the 70s, things changed. So tell me where we're going.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Thank you. I think the important thing that I need to highlight too about Sidney Poitier is that he was emblematic of change, but he was largely the only one too. Mm-hmm. So it kind of tells you again, like we can have a Black movie star, but we can't have too many. And so again, when you compare that to his white counterparts, there were several, you know, white performers who were thriving at that point in time, but Blacks weren't afforded the same opportunities. But the thing that happened to Sidney Poitier is that as we start moving into the 1970s, there's a younger generation that starts to kind of, you know, engage in the struggle for civil rights. And they are more radical in their views. They kind of want equality now and really kind of align themselves with Black power philosophies. And so the shift in imagery starts to change when we move into that period that I mentioned called the Blaxploitation era. And those are films, you know, made between 1970 and 1975 by both black and white filmmakers alike in order to capitalize off the black film audience. And they included black power philosophies in the storylines, even though there were action films, there were detective films, there were horror films. And so that's when some of the representation starts to change. And once that period dries up after 5 years, then there's kind of black erasure in Hollywood where you don't really see many people getting opportunities in front of or behind the camera anymore.
Well, and during that Blaxploitation period, who was going to see those films? I mean, we're talking about how those Sidney Poitier films, they appealed to everybody, white audiences, black audiences. Did that shift in the 70s?
Well, the thing that Hollywood found out, and this will it was a revelation for them. You know, they released a film called Cotton Comes to Harlem, which is the film that kind of kicks off the black exploitation movement. And it does really well at the box office. It was based off this popular series of novels written by a black author. And people go see it, and about 80% of the revenue from that film comes from black audiences. And Hollywood all of a sudden goes, oh, my goodness, black people go to the movies. You know, it only took them to 1970 to figure that out. And so then they start releasing more of those movies. Shaft, 90% of the revenue from that movie comes from black audiences. And so they start making these films to tap into black audiences, because prior to this, they were targeting films, any film, Sidney Poitier films, Steve McQueen films were targeted towards whites. And the black demographic was kind of the extra, so to speak. And so that changes in the 1970s, and they start targeting this younger generation of blacks to go and, you know, to go as who were going to the movies. They start targeting them with those films. And once they stop performing well, for any number of issues, you know, they become formulaic and they don't really expand beyond, you know, kind of this black and white confrontational narrative. The films get old. And so then they just move to blockbusters, you know, films like Jaws and Star Wars and Saturday Night Fever, which did really well with crossover audiences. So they didn't need the black audience anymore like they had.
Right. And if you don't need it, then you're not going to invest the money in making the art that really represents the people in that audience.
And there you have it.
Yeah. So I before we run out of time, I want to jump ahead to the period that we're living in now. I know that your talk on Thursday is going to really focus on Jordan Peele's Get Out. But tell me a little bit, and that came out in 2017. So give me an idea of how you see the moment we are in now.
Mm-hmm. In Hollywood, I think I see this moment as very hopeful. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we have people like Ava DuVernay, you know, making wonderful films like Selma, Wrinkle in Time, Netflix series, When They See Us. And then, you know, we have directors like, you know, Steve McQueen and Barry Jenkins. So we're getting, you know, If Beale Street Could Talk and Widows and some really wonderful films. And of course, we have Tyler Jordan Peele, who has demonstrated that black people can also star in horror films. So I'm very hopeful, but I'm always very optimistic. Kind of pessimistic, rather, even in being hopeful, because I know what Hollywood does. And so I think we're in a good moment. And if people can continue to support black film, keeping in mind that movies starring black people that are about black people are not just for black people. Everyone can go see the films. Right. Like, just like when there are films starring white actors, everyone goes to see them. They're not just for white people. People have to understand that. And if you continue to support black art and black cinema, then this moment can continue on. This is how we sustain.
We had kind of an interesting moment. Was it last year or was it the year before, when we have Moonlight come out and of course, receive incredible critical acclaim. Then we also have The Green Book come out, and that also received incredible critical acclaim. They're films that many people saw and many people loved, but there's also some controversy, because Green Book is yet another film where we sort of have this white savior storyline, and this is something that happens again and again throughout the history of film when we do see black characters. So It was a really good film. I think a lot of people felt that way. How do you feel when you think about some of those tropes coming back in these very high-profile films?
Well, I'm extremely frustrated by that. I find Green Book insulting, to be completely honest, in that they completely co-opt the name of a travel guide that black people used to know where they could go travel when they're moving across the South. This was a real thing. What hotels can I stay in? Where can I stop for gas? The Green Book was a guide. And instead of making a movie about that, told through the eyes of black characters who had to live through that traumatic period, this becomes a film about a white chauffeur driving a black man around while he's on his tour. And of course, it's the story of the white guy overcoming his racism. So you've co-opted a black narrative again in Hollywood. And this is a trope that they do all the time. And so when I see a film like Green Book, it just demonstrates how far we have to go in Hollywood, that you can still take a film about a black issue or a black experience and decide that it's going to be better told if it's through the eyes of a central white character. We also see this in the film The Help, where we have a story about black maids who live in the 1960s starring Emma Stone. And it's her movie. And so I see these films and I think they're ridiculous because, you know, you would never have the biopic about Elvis Presley as told through the eyes of a character of color. We don't see that. But we do that with people of color all the time.
Right. And if we sat down and tried to make a list of these white savior films, we could make a very, very long list over the last 30 years or so. Why do you think it keeps coming back even as this awareness grows?
Well, I think because they're lucrative. We can never underestimate the power of the box office dollar. Hollywood is about making money. And I try to tell my students that all the time. While I would love to tell you that Hollywood is just interested in making nice stories that make us feel good so that we can walk away going, boy, that's fantastic. Hollywood's about making that money. And we have to keep that in mind. So we may have a formula that's tried and true, and people continue to kind of vote, so to speak, with their box office dollars, they're going to stick with it. So that's part of the reason that we see that. And the other thing is that, you know, there just aren't enough people of color in those positions of power to stop these sorts of things. There's a study that those people interested can go and they can access from the USC School of Annenberg, and they can look at the study that they do on Hollywood every year that talks about the composition of executive suites and what people who green light pictures look like. All too often, there aren't enough people of color in there to kind of stop the progression of these tropes because they green light the same thing and things that seem to satisfy their perspectives and their economic agendas.
I want to talk about horror because you want to talk about horror. And I will admit that horror films are something that I avoid like the plague, although I have seen Get Out, and it's very different from most standard horror films. I mean, it's such a brilliant, brilliant movie. But let's talk about black actors, black characters in horror traditionally.
Yeah. What black actors in horror? No, I'm joking. No, I'm sorry. I'm playing. Well, you know, it's kind of aside from there have been some moments. You know, I think probably one of the best examples would be A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead, where in 1968 you have this character Ben, who's played by a black man, and he's in this group of all white people, and he's the leader, and that is one of the most significant representations of black people in horror because he doesn't die first, right? which is you know, one of the
groundbreaking
stuff that we kind of joke about is that, you know, a lot of times if you start watching those horror films, and that's, you know, you think about a lot of the slasher films in the 80s or contemporary films, but if there's a black character, generally speaking, they're not going to be around to the end of the film. That's just kind of the way it goes.
the guy in the red shirt on Star Trek. This is just a thing we know, right?
That guy, like, we know they're done, right?
Yep.
So we've seen what we can say black omission or black erasure from the horror genre for an extended period of time. And when they have been included, when blacks have been included, very rarely have they been the heroes. Now, there's some exceptions. You know, Tales from the Hood featured a black protagonist. There's a movie right now called Sweetheart that's kind of a horror film that features a black protagonist, Jordan Peele's Us and Get Out. So there have been exceptions over the years, but it's very rare that we have seen blacks, you know, considered or be a viable part of the horror genre.
So with Jordan Peele and Get Out, and even if you hate horror movies like I do, I do recommend spending some time with this film. I realize I was probably one of the last people to see it because it was so incredibly popular because it is so brilliant. But he turns this whole genre on its ear in so many ways. For people who aren't familiar with the film, can you give me an idea of what makes this so groundbreaking?
Well, I tell you, it's groundbreaking, first of all, because, again, it centers Black people in the horror tradition, like firmly, very much so. And it plays around, you know, with the concept of space and safety. So, for example, in this film, one of the things that Peele establishes brilliantly is that in the city, Chris feels very safe. In his apartment, this is a place where, you know, he's surrounded by people who look like him, even though he's in a multiracial space. He feels comfortable. But then he goes out to the country, and that idea of what it's like to be the only one amongst a group of people who also deny that racism exists, Jordan Peele plays around with that. So there's this tension that's created in that moment. And this is something that I think if you live in a place where there aren't many people who look like you, that you can experience. And it's not like you can't be surrounded by good folks who don't look like you, but there can always be some tension there. And there's a psychological trauma that can come along with that. So Peele brilliantly and subtly kind of comments upon the notion of space and safety in regard to Black bodies. And I think that that's just one of the wonderful critiques that he includes in that film.
Yeah, well, and of course it builds. You feel that tension, which is sort of the basic way that our society is built right now. And then, mm-hmm. of course, it grows, and there is a great deal to be frightened of.
Absolutely. There is plenty to be frightened of because, you know, a lot of things, and I feel like I've been saying this a lot lately, is some people who would want to do you harm, they hide in plain sight, right? You don't know. Like, when you walk in, your body is racialized if you are Black, and all kinds of assumptions can be made. When you are white in this country, you have the ability to kind of hide in plain sight. I don't see your political agenda as soon as I see you, right? But you can make assumptions about what someone Black's political agenda is as soon as you're seen. So in that way, your body is racialized and it's politicized, and always in some ways there can be a threat of danger. That's some serious trauma to live with.
This moment has been very good for Black film, Black directors, Black actors. And as you said, you're always going to be a little pessimistic that we're making real progress until you see it. What does real progress look like? If you give into a little bit of that optimism that's lurking there, what do you think? What do you think we can see and should see?
Okay, so first of all, this is 2020, so I will not be giving into that optimism this year.
That's fair.
I'll be very clear about that. But I think that, you know, I want to see what happens. We can herald, let's take Jordan Peele, for example. We can herald him right now. He's Get Out, Us. He does The Twilight Zone for CBS All Access. He's producing other projects. He's, you know, one of the producers on Spike Lee's latest movie, Defied Bloods. I want to see what happens when Jordan Peele, you know, puts out a film and it doesn't do well. I think that's when we're going to start to figure it out. When Barry Jenkins makes a film and people say, that's not a masterpiece. Will they get other opportunities? Will we be able to sustain? And then will we continue to get stories that depict a range of Black identities? Because certainly the whole problem with the cinema has not necessarily been that Black people have, you know, had to play maybe a slave or a maid. It's been that they play those characters in the absence of everything else, that we're not doctors, lawyers, teachers, criminals, you know, athletes, the range of representation afforded their white counterparts. So one, what's going to happen when one of those directors like a Jordan Peele or Ava DuVernay has a film that's not a hit? And then can we continue to tell stories that position Black people as multidimensional characters and not one-dimensional caricatures? That's the question.
And do you feel like film has lagged behind television in making this progress? Because we, of course, have seen some really extraordinary television in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that if we talk about network television, then no, I think film is far ahead of NBC, CBS, because they are tied to advertisers. And so therefore, you see a lot of the same formulas on network TV. even a show like This Is Us falls into the trap of tokenizing black people. And that show is a big hit. But if you look at that show, it's ultimately a great white savior show, too. And so, you know, you see a lot of tokenized blacks on network television. You have to have formulas that are going to draw advertisers. And as a result, you know, you get a show like Black-ish, but you don't really see a whole range of those shows. Blacks are oftentimes relegated to supporting characters in those TV programs. Now, the beautiful thing about television is that, you know, streaming services like Hulu and Netflix and cable channels like FX and HBO, they're allowed to go, you know, farther than network television because they're more reliant upon subscribers, so they get their money up front. So therefore, they can be bold in their programming. And that's why we get shows like, you know, The Wire on HBO or a program like Woke, because they don't have to worry about advertisers saying we're not going to advertise as much as, say, network television. So the revenue streams are different.
Yeah. And so we are out of time, but enjoyed this so much. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to your talk on Thursday, White Mansions, Black Bodies, Jordan Peele's Get Out, and the New Age Slave Plantation, Novotny Lawrence of Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa.